My name is Brendan Sharkey, chair of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I'm here with now again, good to see him, our vice chair, Lyle Ray. And thanks again to the CROG for hosting the Zoom meeting. This is the subcommittee meeting, the standing subcommittee meeting of ACIR to address specific issues as they arise throughout our each month. This is a Zoom meeting. It's being recorded. So if you wish to be recognized to speak, please let me know by doing the raise hand function, and we'll make sure that you get recognized. And we will have an opportunity for folks who might be listening in who are not ACIR members to also contribute. So with that, this could either be a very long or a very short meeting, it seems to me. At the last subcommittee, well, I guess it was at the full ACIR meeting, right? At the beginning of March, we took up the work of the subcommittee at the meeting of the full ACIR. Around the question of adopting the CAPS blueprint to transform Connecticut public schools or variations thereof. I think I'll try to summarize as best I can, but I think the outcome of that discussion at the full ACIR meeting, I had prepared a draft letter on the ACIR's behalf to the governor that would have encouraged him to reconsider within his budget deliberations and in his negotiations with the legislature, to perhaps integrate some of the expected federal money under the ESSER grant to potentially reallocate some of that towards the goals that CAPS had outlined in their blueprint, which we had discussed in two previous subcommittee meetings leading up to the full meeting at the beginning of March. It was not voted on at the full ACIR meeting on March, that was March 2nd. I think due to some concerns that members had raised about, first of all, the wisdom of raising these kinds of issues with the governor generally, but more specifically, whether or not we felt that we were ready to make specific recommendations based upon what the subcommittee had previously been discussing. I think that's probably a diplomatic way of putting it. So we agreed to use our regularly scheduled subcommittee meeting time to go back and perhaps rethink the recommendation that we might be making to the governor's office and, for that matter, the legislative leadership as they deliberate on the budget. Again, along the lines of purposing the federal money from ESSER towards some of the highlighted recommendations from CAPS that could be actually implemented using those funds. So that's my summary of where we are. And I think our purpose of the subcommittee meeting today is to kind of determine whether, in fact, we want to go proceed with a recommendation to the governor's office again, and if so, how that would look, or if not, we can let it go and move on from the discussion. I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything or add any color to where we stand as a result of our meeting earlier this month. Is that a fair summary of where we are? Okay. So I guess the question then is, what do we want to do with that? Do we want to more finely tune the draft letter that I had submitted for everyone's consideration? I think was fairly strongly worded, I guess, in terms of its recommendations. But and I think some members of ACIR were perhaps pushing back a little bit on that as to whether that was a good idea or not. But more specifically, where do we want to go with the CAPS proposal? And I'm opening it up for folks as to where you guys think we should go with that. Yeah, John.
I'll start it off. I don't have a real issue with the letter itself. Generally speaking, the proposal itself, you know, is large with 30 recommendations and all sorts of subsets to that. And I don't know how the vote would actually go with the full ACIR. We didn't really have a straw poll from the others, but I guess what I think in terms of that's one step. And then I think there's elements within their proposals that may be jumping off places for ACIR to do that don't necessarily contradict what's in that blueprint, but are studies on regionalism, transportation, and some other subjects that we might want to take a deeper dive into as part of the local government of the future. So I guess where I'm looking at is going forward with an endorsement of the follow through with the letter, but then perhaps picking out a few of the topics that are not fully fleshed out, or maybe they are and I just haven't seen them, but that may be good topics for us that are consistent with the local government of the future piece, and start to work on that from our perspective.
Yeah, I guess, thanks for that. And you're helping me kind of fine-tune my thoughts on this too. So I think what became the obstacle at the last meeting was the notion of sending a letter recommending that the governor redo his budget, basically, with these items in mind. And that, I think, was the sticking point for a lot of folks. I don't think anybody had a problem necessarily with the CAP's priorities and recommendations. It was more about whether we should be confronting the governor's office directly with thoughts about how the governor should go about handling the ESSER funds once they arrive. And obviously those members of ACIR who work for the administration, obviously were not going to be involved in making a recommendation contrary to what their boss's recommendations are. That's, I think, where we may have, where the obstacles may have arisen at the last meeting. Leah?
Yeah, I would just agree with what you just said, that, you know, SDE is in, support of the recommendations by CAP. As we've said before, we want to increase student achievement. We'd want to tie it to some sort of outcomes and whatnot. We can't endorse changing the governor's budget. And we're also leery of pointing to ESSER II funds that could be used for this rather than, COVID, due to COVID implications. So those were our two concerns, I think. Thank you.
Right. And again, thanks, Leah. And again, just to reiterate, what we had asked CAPS to do was to identify potential program recommendations that might be eligible for ESSER funding. And that was really the focus of the letter, which was to say for those fine-tuned recommendations that we think are eligible for ESSER funding, would you please consider, doing so towards a larger, longer term vision of where our local schools can go. So any other thoughts on that? I think I have a sense of where we're going with this, but I want to make sure I'm allowing others to offer up their thoughts. Yeah, Jim.
Uh, I raised this issue before as it relates to various subject matters that we'd like to bring forth. But this is one of those, you know, I support many of these ideas that are contained in this CAPS recommendation. But I have the sense that this is kind of one of these exercises that we get into that will end up being doomed because there just is too much change involved in the recommendation. And so back to my points that I've made previously, it seems to me that in order to really make an effort to be successful at this, we need to address this change management process that we've talked about. We need to figure out what it is about this. This needs to be studied in depth from a change management point of view to see where the obstacles are and to address the obstacles. You know, I suppose, I mean, going at it the way we are, it sort of, to my mind, is kind of like throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. And if you really want to get this accomplished, it needs considerable study and homework and background work done in order to address the obstacles that are sure to be out there. But that's just my point of view.
So, so that's really helpful, Jim. I'm wondering, so is it your thought that maybe, yeah, that it's as recommendations go, the CAPS blueprint is not fully baked enough for us to be able to tell the governor, look, you know, here's what you need to do with this money that's coming in, right? Is that a fair?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm seeing other people nodding their head. So let me ask this question, and this is sort of where I thought we were going to. Thanks, Deborah. That if ACIR were to communicate its support of the CAPS blueprint generally without making the extra recommendation that ESSER is what you should do to implement these things, but instead say generally, look, we think this is an important blueprint that reflects where we think the state should be going. You know, please consider this as you deliberate over the budget with legislative leaders between now and the end of session, and keep these items in mind, but otherwise leave it open-ended as to how that actually gets done. Is that a more appropriate message to send than the original draft of it as far as it being more directly related? How do folks feel? Leah's weighing in with her thumbs up, but
This is Deb. I'm just wondering how effective would that even be, to be honest with you? I mean, we've spent so much time vetting it, like how effective would it be in them really considering it because we've recommended it? And do we then also recommend it to the legislature and send it to the appropriations and the education chairs and not just leave it in the hands of the governor's office?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a good point. What I meant to say was that, yeah, not just to the governor, but to all relevant folks who are going to be sitting down looking at the budget between now and the end of the session. You know, an endorsement from ACIR. Yeah, I mean, are we necessarily the final word on how state funds should be expended on education? Of course not. But if it comes, if we are able to endorse the general concept of what CAPS is proposing, maybe that adds a little bit of weight to what they're recommending beyond just what they currently have. So we can be supportive without necessarily trying to tell tell the leaders what to do with it. You know, is it going to be, as I say, is it going to, it maybe it moves the needle to some degree, but will it, you know, change the world? No. Marcia.
I think that us shedding light on the report and saying that we're supportive of the efforts that have been made to highlight as also, I think it's important because I think it keeps it alive. And once it goes kind of dormant, if it doesn't pick up momentum and support, it's never going to see the light of day eventually. I think ACIR, you know, who are we, right? I mean, the reality of it is we're just an extension of a group that never really has gotten much momentum, but just has such great talent here with all of you that brings a pool of people together for mindful conversation and thought process that really could maybe put an injection into it. So, I mean, I think that at the last meeting we determined that we would write with support for certain particular low-hanging fruit in there that in a generalized way, if I'm not wrong. And I think it's important for us to weigh in on the work that has been done that identifies moving education in the state of Connecticut forward. So I'm in support of us putting something out there that really kind of highlights that it has some backing for whatever that means, that it's worthy for people to review, consider, and really look at it and to put some funding towards it. Because we know that in education, we need to move the needle, especially in communities, distressed municipalities, especially during a time when equity is an issue.
Good. Thank you, Marcia. Brian?
Thank you. Yeah, I think we're, you know, one of the things I think that we should try to do is maybe if we can pick one thing that seems to have some universal appeal for all of our stakeholders. And I think part of that is unpausing the delay that's in the governor's budget for ECS. I think that at least sets the foundation, because if not, we're trying to catch up. So let's just maintain what we're supposed to be doing. And then I think as part of that letter, and that's something that's being debated now. I know SDE probably can't sign off here today on it, but it is being negotiated between legislative leaders on the probes and in the governor's office. And I think the other part of it is a lot of this stuff, you know, maybe the conversations when the governor starts putting their budget together is actually in September, October for the following year. So maybe this is something that we highlight saying, hey, we want to have discussions in, you know, July or August and try to put some of these pieces so that he'll consider it for his budget within OPM and that universe and SDE. Just a thought. That way maybe we can grab a victory, but also plant the seeds for future conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, fundamentally it's really up to CAPS, I think, to be able to, you know, sell this or not. And it's their work. It's their work product. We're just commenting on their work, but yeah, to the extent that we can collaborate with CAPS to kind of help, move their agenda forward, because we endorse it. Right. Plant the seeds in the summer. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think, you know, part of, you know, the CAPS agenda, while obviously we have differences sometimes, is also kind of our agenda, you know, funding for education, you know, special ed. These are things that we're tackling when we put our budgets together, you know, from a municipal perspective, general government perspective.
Well, Brian, you also raised the other, a good question too, which is, should we, so you're right. And I'm glad you pointed it out that another real part of that letter to the governor was about the pause of ECS increases going forward. And that was another element of the, you know, to what degree can we or should we be advocating a change in the governor's policy? What's your thought about with or without the CAPS proposal, what is your, you know, I have a feeling that ACIR is not necessarily, I think the sense of the meeting last week, earlier this month was that we may not be in a great position to opine about the pause of the ECS funding. That's maybe weighing it a little too deep into some, into the deep end of the pool, but rather we should, I don't know, you know, so do you think that we should, as a group, do you still think that we should be weighing in on the question of the pause versus not the pause?
That's a fair question. And thinking about it more politically, I think actually, yes, we assert ourselves because you know what? I think Marcia sort of alluded to, we get together, we have some good people, good ideas that come out of this group, but they don't move forward. Let's try to be relevant and assert ourselves into the conversations.
All but not aggressively.
you can assert yourself without being confrontational too.
That's true. I'm an advocate for that. Yeah, Leah.
I probably know what I'm going to say, but SD it can't really be a part of telling the governor how to do his budget. We need to be supportive of what came out. So including that, unfortunately.
Or abstain.
Abstain, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what I'm hearing is yes, we should be communicating to not just governor, but leaders generally as they prepare their go into the room to start putting the budget together. Endorse the CAPS blueprint, not weigh in on the application of ESSER funds necessarily for that implementation, although we could throw it out there as an idea. But third, to offer an opinion that, you know, the suspension of the already scheduled ECS increases, should be reconsidered going forward. And it's, you know, it's a position that we've kind of evolved around, thanks to, in part, to our discussion about the CAPS blueprint, but also just because I think our membership are uniquely affected by what may or may not happen as a result of that suspension. And it's led, so the CAPS proposal led to a deeper conversation about this. Bruce, I'm sorry, you had your hand raised. Did you want to add something to that?
Yes, I just, first of all, I'll echo everything Leah said about not taking a position on something contrary to the governor, but I did want to toss in the thought that the ACIR is not just another advocacy group. ACIR does research on things that matter. And so to the extent that you are going in and picking out a sample of recommendations, whether it be one thing about ECS or a couple others, that could be a good research topic to hand off to, say, a student intern or for the subcommittee to tackle in these monthly meetings, and so that your correspondence to the governor and legislator could include an offer to look into it, and you could reach out to towns, to school districts of all different sizes, all the kinds of things the ACIR cares about, and put together a response and say, here's information coming from this very nonpartisan but very broad-based group that can help steer them next in the fall when they're putting together the next budget or putting together next year's legislation. So that's just the thought I wanted to put out there.
Yeah. So Bruce, so along those lines, what you're, if I can rephrase or, recast what I think you're saying, so that we on the CAPS blueprint in particular, we could perhaps offer to work with CAPS to put a little bit more color into how to actually implement their recommendations. Is that so? It would be, you know, do that over the course of a few months, but in collaboration with CAPS. Is that kind of your thought on that?
I actually have had no thought about whether CAPS is involved in that or not. That does make a lot of sense, but it was more just to offer to the legislature and to the governor, who between them appointed a lot of ACIR members, to say, we offer to review these particular topics that are right in the ACIR, right in the heart of the ACIR mission. And, you know, in addition to saying that you're interested in the blueprint, you also are interested in researching this further. You could offer to do it with CAPS. That makes a lot of sense. But that I had not thought about CAPS in that way when I said it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts on how to proceed on this? So I think where we are is letter leaders to leaders endorsing CAPS, the CAPS proposal, with the understanding that certain members of ACIR would need to abstain from this, but that we endorse the CAPS proposal generally, and we encourage those leaders as they're putting their budgets together to not suspend the ECS increases that had already been scheduled. So it's basically two messages in that. And then Bruce's idea of, you know, we're here and we're available to look into these issues a little bit more detail if you'd like us to, because this is part of our mission. I'm happy to kind of redraft what I've already drafted and throw that out to folks for consideration.
Yep. Sounds good for my two cents.
That works. Sounds like what we've talked about.
Okay. Great. Okay. So I'll do that and get that out. Now we don't have, but we would want, and it's plenty of time actually, even though our normal date for a full meeting would be April 2nd, but that's Good Friday. So our next meeting is actually not until April 9th, but that's still plenty of time. For leaders, they're not going to be anywhere near finishing up on their budget discussions by then. So, okay. So we'll have that prepared for the full committee on April 9th. Thank you. That's helpful conversation. The other thing I just wanted to update, since we're in the subcommittee itself, the LGF initiative subcommittee generally, I did want to report that the Planning and Development Committee did have their public hearing yesterday on the governor's bill, which was HB 6448, which included in sections 9 and 10 our proposal on the RPIP grant. The bill generally included a number of things that the governor was recommending as far as codifying certain local government procedures that had been suspended due to the COVID executive orders. But the governor was recommending that some of those things, including meeting notices and requirements, be codified as a procedure to continue on. And then in addition, the governor's office was good enough to include in two sections our recommendations on the repurposing of the RPIP grant. I did Lyle and I submitted testimony for yesterday's hearing. I attended and did the presentation on ACIR's behalf yesterday. And while with one exception, I guess, in John's from a representative from John's neck of the woods, it was wholeheartedly endorsed. I did walk into a bit of a political buzzsaw because the rest of the bill dealt with other aspects of public notices and public participation that would continue to be suspended or would be codified, some of the changes to those things being codified going forward. And there were several comments that I was asked to opine about as far as whether or not we were shutting down democracy in Connecticut by continuing to limit access, what I think some folks view as limiting access to public participation by retaining a lot of the virtual meeting recommendations and procedures that we've put in place thus far. So it was an interesting discussion. I wasn't really prepared to talk about that, certainly not on ACIR's behalf, but I was speaking extemporaneously when I could. But I think generally speaking, there's a lot of receptivity to what ACIR has proposed and a lot of praise for the work that we did on that. So, yeah, Margaret.
Yes, I was watching. You were terrific.
Oh, thanks.
As was John and others, I think I noticed too also. So thanks. I'm sorry. You did very well.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, you know, it's my old stomping ground because I used to chair.
Yeah. And
so this was friendly territory. So that made it a little easier, as Brian knows. So that's the update on that. I don't know what might happen to the rest of the bill. I'm imagining that P&D generally is very supportive. There were also some other issues raised at the public hearing in my questioning that we as a body may want to actually consider studying further with regard to the implementation of the RPIP repurposing. We, by the way, in the testimony, Lyle and I referred to it as RPIP 2.0, just to distinguish it from the Local Government of the Future initiative. So I was trying to keep these things in separate lanes. But I think it went generally well. So thanks, Margaret, for the props on that. Any other questions or comments from the group? Yeah, John.
I just raised one thing that it came up yesterday during multiple bills during that hearing, and most definitely in the week before. And I don't know if it's an area that we should become engaged in or in terms of research to follow up, I think, on Bruce's suggestion. But there seems to be, and I'll call it confusion, as to what constitutes home rule and what is home rule. What are the rights and sovereign rights, as I've heard that phrase a few times too, of towns relative to the state and vice versa. Not picking sides here, but obviously I work for towns. But that's that notion of home rule and how it's perceived in terms of and being used politically. I don't know. I'm getting a greater and greater concern that it's being perhaps misused. There at the Capitol. And I don't know if that's an area that where it's too hot to get into, but maybe I'm not explaining myself, but it's a phrase that's thrown around, I think, uh-huh. without a lot of understanding of what it actually means. So I don't know if that's something for further research that this group might want to get into or not, or is it something we don't want to touch at all?
John, can you just, there are a couple of folks who have raised their hands, but can you just be a little bit more specific as to how the phrase was used?
Any number of pieces of legislation that have come up, whether it deals with housing or some of the questioning you have are perceived as an intrusion on the rights of an individual municipality.
Right.
You saw that yesterday. There was a fairly innocuous bill on standardization of GIS for GIS standards that was attacked because it was an intrusion on home rule. There is a balance in there somewhere. And it is becoming more and more political than it's always been there, but it's become more political this session And maybe it's a rallying point for folks of a certain political persuasion. But I don't necessarily believe that in the way it's being used, it's constructive or fully constructive towards solving problems.
Yeah.
But it seems to come up, you know, on an awful lot of issues that you just would not hear that phrase or that challenge. Okay, this is, why are you doing this? And it's not from one or two legislators. It's from a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. And I just should just add, you're reminding me, I was actually solicited by the Desegregate Connecticut group, who we heard from over the summer, Sarah Bronin's group, asking that I provide testimony in support of their initiatives on a bill that was in front of, it was last week. I don't think it was planning development. I'm trying to remember which committee was in front of. And I politely declined because I just didn't feel that was something. I mean, ACIR had not taken a formal position to support a legislative proposal from DSEG Connecticut. And so I didn't feel it was appropriate to be offering up testimony on the group's behalf or individually for that matter, given my association with ACIR. So I just wanted to put that on the record that I was actually asked about that, but declined. Margaret, and then Bruce.
Yes, I just wanted to, Bruce might be saying the same thing. One of the first studies that ACIR did in the last century was about home rule. You might want to dig it out of someplace and just polish it off, or to understand the concept of, you know, I know people in Greenwich think, oh, well, we have home rule because we have, they gave us a special charter or something like that. And other, I've always felt it was people who had towns that had charters. You know, so it would be good to remind people what it's supposed to, what home rule means.
Yeah. Bruce, was that where you were going?
That is exactly what I was going to say. And I'm glad you went to her first, because I would say Margaret might remember it, but I was uncertain of how old it was and didn't want to put years on her. I looked it up. I have it online. I don't have the original electronic version of it, but I scanned it. I took it out of the state library, and it is online at the ACIR site, and I'll circulate it to the members.
Yeah,
it's a 1987 report. And you might consider going back through it, and based on the additional, whatever that is, 34 years of misuse of the term, ACIR might want to spend a little time and rework it for the year 2021.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Great minds think alike, obviously. Lyle?
Yeah, thank you for this. As a sort of, student of constitutional government, people forget that we're a Dillon rule state, which means local governments can only do what the state tells them to do. The question of home rule is actually quite different in the South, when the state government acts by prohibiting local governments from doing things. It's quite a different when you're not a Dillon rule state. So in Connecticut, anything, the granting of a charter or particular activities, is constitutionally reserved to the state. And local governments are literally a creature of state government, and regardless of the home rule thing. That's my first point. So we can go back to the Dillon rule and the Supreme Court and all that stuff, and maybe it's in that 1987 report. The other thing about this, I keep hearing the way it's used reminds me of states' rights. You know, the way that, in other words, it's used to squelch, anti-racist thing. In other words, it's not used for highway construction. It's used for certain touchy social issues and a rallying cry, as John said, politically. So it reminds me of this sort of a mirror image of the states' right rally. The other thing that's interesting, and just to throw it out there, whenever we hear of giving COGS more power, people say, oh my God, it sounds like county government that would bossing towns around. Well, again, going back to the fact of this, counties never boss localities around, period, end of story. They're independent levels of government. In other words, having been a county manager with 450,000 people, I would not stand a chance of telling one of my 10 cities what to do. It doesn't work that way. So, but anyway, going back to this, I think the Dillon rule aspect, the constitutional history, and going back to this, I mean, it actually goes back to, you'll like this stuff. A lot of this stuff goes back to the Norman invasion in 1066 in England in terms of what was local rights and what are, you know, national and higher rights. But the Dillon rule very much specifically says in this country, I don't remember the ratio, maybe some of you do on the call, but the Dillon rule states tend to be in the north and the non-Dillon rule states tend to be in the south and the west. And the way it works in Connecticut is a local government can only do what they're specifically charged by state statute to do. But for example, if you're in Las Vegas and you're a local government and want to do a casino, you can, unless you can point to a state law that forbids. It's just a very different approach rather than mother may I with the legislature. You can do whatever you damn well please, except as prohibited by state statute. Here, you generally need enactment authority granted by the state legislature to do most things. So I'm just saying that it's a very interesting, an interesting aspect, but the way these words are used and by whom they're used and under what topics are used really kind of concerns me just in terms of, you know, it's not, as I say, it's not about, you know, bike paths and highway systems. It's about very touchy social issues. So that's my two cents worth. So.
Yeah. Thanks. I don't know. Maybe it is something we need to spend a little time on. Bob.
Just on the whole issue of home rule, it's often smaller towns. It's towns, and particularly as it relates to desegregate Connecticut and the as a matter of right proposals that are within that proposal for land use. I think towns have, and the legislature has through statute, created a statute that gives autonomy to municipalities when it comes to land use regulation. It is part of, to take what Lyle said, part of what is enabled by legislation. And what's being proposed and what rubs people the wrong way and they start to use the home rule argument is the proposal is to make as a matter of right certain things within land use that don't currently exist. And so just for clarification, when people use that, it, you know, others may not like it because of its political overtones or whatever it may be, but that is, at least on that land use issue, that is the genesis of it, that they believe, I mean, you can go back to colonial times when colonists thought they were given the right to do certain things legislatively. And then when the king came in and said, well, no, you really can't do that, I'm going to change that rule, and it ended up in a revolution. But
just a footnote, what Bob was saying, you know, land use control is one of the oldest local prerogatives. You know, in terms of what local governments do in the U.S. and the U.K., that was one of the things in terms of managing the land use within a boundary of a town was something that there was less, less subject to interference from the outside. And so that's why I think the point about local control and land use and impacts is historically that has been true. That and there are exceptions, as you know, Bob, in terms of group homes, et cetera, et cetera. There are areas where the state has said, from a state perspective, we need to limit that local authority. But it's one of those very old prerogatives of local government is management of the land use within their boundaries. So that's why I think people are using that local control. But I'd be interested in seeing that paper whenever Bruce sends it out. Again, I'm sort of interested in that. The other tidbit, having grown up in Canada, it's a very interesting thing. We have a fossilized system in the United States where the local government never changes very much. I mean, the boundaries since the 19th century in the capital region haven't changed much. And, you know, East Hartford, West Hartford, and Hartford split up in the 19th century. When you look at other, particularly Westminster democracies, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom itself, they actually do radical reorganizations of local government that cause a stroke here. So just to give you an example where I did my PhD, the city of Winnipeg had six suburbs in 1970, and the legislature says, gee, we can't have people fleeing the core city for the suburbs, so let's just merge them all. And while we're at it, let's have one fire department, one police department, and one school district. Have a nice day. So May 1970, they merged seven entities into the region of Winnipeg. And I'll name a place in this country where you could even consider that without being, you know, having your knees cut off. So we have a very I mean, counties go back to the 12th century, so I remember it well. But we are very fossilized in our structures of government. And if you look, and I teach this stuff internationally, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom have restructured local government like four or five times since 1945. You know, it's a very different structure. We're very stuck in our ways. And, you know, we have our charter from Charles II, God damn it, and don't touch it. So we're very structured and kind of set in our ways, particularly in the, you know, east of the Mississippi. But I appreciate your comment. And local land use is one of those areas where it's very dear to the hearts of local control, which is a, you know, very long-term issue. So sorry I rambled on there, Mr. Chair.
No, it's good history. Yeah, and something that maybe we can, once Bruce sends that around, we can maybe take a look at it and maybe have a further discussion about it, either in a subcommittee or full committee context. Oh. Yeah, Margaret.
There were some very interesting recommendations. I can't remember them off the top of my head, but it was a thoughtful report. You can tell from the typewriter that was used, it's really
I was going to say the parchment. Don't crack the parchment when you unroll it, right?
Margaret, why can't you have total recall on that? Come on. Wait,
1987 is like yesterday, right?
Right, exactly.
I'm not a politician, but I'm careful.
Fair enough. John, and then Chip.
I mean, I hesitated to bring it up, but I think it is an issue that is creeping into a lot of discussion. And if we can add some clarity to it, I'm not suggesting a position for change or whatever, but I do think there's a good amount of assumption and misinformation on that. I asked one open question with a group. I said, well, if you want total local control or home rule on land use, strike everything after the second sentence and say towns are enabled to zone, period. There's about 30 or so shalls in that statute right now that the state says you shall do it this way.
Right.
You don't have an option. So it's not as cut and dry as it's being portrayed from either side. I think it warrants, you know, maybe some updating of that 1987 report. Certainly what Lyle is going through with that history, and just part of what we're supposed to be is a resource on these things and foster some discussion. And I think it could be, it may well be beneficial.
Well, yeah, particularly in the context of, you know, I think generally the group was supportive of the, again, generally supportive of the presentation that we received from Sarah Bronin back in the summer. And folks were, our members, I think, were sympathetic to a lot of the issues that she was raising. You know, I'll speak for myself. I think there's some other aspects of not only what DSEG Connecticut was proposing that may be a little bit short-sighted in terms of the history. And, you know, here in Connecticut, just in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, for example, I kind of felt as though when we were making the point about how so often sanitary sewer systems are, believe it or not, a thing that a lot of municipalities hang their hats on for how their zoning needs to happen. And that's not illegitimate, you know, that the need for maintaining, if you don't have a sewer system, you've got to have septics and you have to have a certain amount of area for a healthy septic system and systems to proliferate. I'm not sure that kind of resonated with Sarah or with others. You know, as to some of the other, several members pointed out, health districts are, you know, at the core of a lot of why zoning is the way it is in Connecticut. Maybe we should think about how health districts go about developing their own regulations for septics that might actually encourage more density, which might actually break down some of these things. I'm speaking for myself. I didn't really get the sense that there was a lot of interest in diving into that. you know, but I think those kinds of things are really at the core of this. And I did want to catch Jim because I know he had his hand raised. Did you have a comment, Jim?
Thank you. I guess now that I've heard John's comments and your comments, I'll leave my comment to third, first of all, this whole issue of racial recognition or equality and trying to even the playing field with regard to those issues, I support that, but surely that's an area that is fraught with danger before you stir up a hornet's nest, it again better to try to plan what would be something that you could accomplish that would actually work, that would make things better. So as it relates to that, so the second thing is back to Margaret and Bruce. The home rule thing is one of these complicated issues, and I think it would be good to go back to that 1987 report and look at that. And by the way, hi Margaret, it's good to see you. That would be a place to begin a study of that issue. And then the issue that I originally raised my hand on has to do with just a wonderment as I've been sitting here thinking. Brandon, you mentioned the word endorse as it relates to the CAPS initiative. And I'm wondering if the word endorse, it's just a thought, but does the word endorse in our context of recommending to the governor and the legislature, does that have baggage with that word? Should it be that we recommend for consideration or that we support versus using the word endorse? It's just a question. I don't know. Endorse to my mind means you have a platform that you, a concept that you, in its entirety, you wanted to see it move forward and executed. And I'm not sure that ACIR is there with the CAPS recommendations. There's so much in there, that's my question: whether endorse is the right word.
And maybe that's a discussion for the larger group too when at our next meeting. I did get the sense that there was a consensus in principle around the notion of where CAPS was coming from.
Yes, I agree.
So in that context, I thought, you know, I that's why I used the word endorse, but I hear your point that you know, maybe that's a phrase that is a little too could be maybe a little bit too direct, and maybe it needs to be modified a little bit to reflect endorsing the concept of it, but not necessarily specific principles. I mean, I think there are different ways we could phrase it. So let's think a little bit more about that. But thanks, Jim. And John, I'm just getting back to you.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, we're talking about going back to a 1987 study, which I look forward to looking at, and I probably looked at it at one point and have forgotten, but there's a good amount of studies that this body had done previously back when David Russell was there, and also the Institute for Public Service at UConn had put out that were good documents in their day that are sort of frozen in time in the late 80s, 90s, and even before. And perhaps if we can maybe take a look at a few of those and identify what would be beneficial for not only this group, but elected officials, whether they be on boards of education, the boards of selectmen, town councils today, and with our connection with UConn, perhaps look to update some of those to current times and get them circulated, because there's a lot of knowledge in there that would be beneficial, I think, for in particular the people I work for, elected officials at the at the local level, and even if you were talking about the desegregate stuff in housing, 8-30G, which is the housing statute, which is sort of the heart of a lot of this debate, came in the, this is dating me, but I remember when it came in the late 80s, and I may be the only one or one of two or three people here that remember that. That was flawed when it came in, because it was a huge compromise. And I know this mainly because recently I've been talking to the authors of that bill, who I still are long since retired from the legislature, but there's a lot of history there as well. So if we can learn from the past, and we had Lyle going all the way back to the Normandy invasion and so forth as well. So I think it would be good to look at some of those older publications and see what can we as a body, work to update and bring up to 2021, and then how do we deliver that to through working with partnership with CCM and on the education side with those groups. I don't know. I think there's opportunities there to do some good work.
Well, those were my halcyon days back at UConn Law School with Terry Tondro. So
Terry,
how I cut my teeth on this. Issues. Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
I do too. The only other thing I would add to this is that in the past, going back even before that review, was the A95 review, and the feds would say, you don't have to do this, but you don't get any money for sewers. And so where I was in the Midwest, unless you made provision for affordable housing with specific targets, you got no funding for infrastructure. So that got people's attention. So many of these things also, the other dimension in addition to law is the exercise of strong financial incentives from higher levels of government. In other words, there's a great line from a Florida congressperson who said, if you make a carrot big enough, it looks an awful lot like a stick, which is a great line. But it's like the A95 review, which is, you can have $1 billion for your sewer program. If you have an affordable housing program, you don't have to. The federal government has kind of faded out of these areas. But I'm saying that was another whole dimension, which is, strong federal or state incentives for local behavior can override, local preferences to a certain extent if it's a big enough amount in terms of meeting local needs. So, but that's another dimension. I second John's idea. I think it makes a great deal of sense to take a peek at this. And if not us, who then, I guess, is the question. I don't see anyone else. This is our bailiwick.
Right. Agreed. Well, Bruce, maybe you can also add that as a topic for our next meeting. Yeah, Jim.
Well, I was just going to say, could that be given to Bruce to perhaps Bruce, I don't know, do you have time to peruse the list and see what might be two or three or four interesting topics to get started on?
I did that once before. I went over to the library, and things that I was able to take out, I took a few interesting things out and scanned them. This happened to be one. Let me do this. Rather than have me make a decision, I'll take a little time and compile what I think is a complete list of ACIR reports over at the State Library. Sometimes the titles are a little deceiving. They're not as interesting as the title appears. But anyway, that can be part of that same agenda item that Brendan mentioned. And I'll circulate this report I have here and a list of all the other reports that are available, and let the full group decide what to do.
Right. There's also the stuff from the Institute of Public Service that, there's a guidebook there for boards of finance that we still give out. I think it's from 1993 or six. And it's still a very good document, but it is dated.
And so, again, to John's point, you know, Massachusetts next door does a lot more guidance in those kind of areas than we do. The state government in Massachusetts has a lot of specific guidance for councils of governments or school districts or whatever. And we just have, you know, somewhere 25 years ago just stopped.
Well, that's a great point, Lyle. And I don't mean to belabor this, but it's a great point because we have already talked as a group about best practices and putting together best practices in a new post-COVID world, as well as just generally. And yep. So maybe in that context, that makes that actually does make a lot more sense. Margaret, you had a...
Yeah, I think some of the... We used to do these conferences, and my husband and I would video them for you. And I think there was one that was particularly interesting. And we did have some people from Massachusetts and whatever as part of the... I forget, it was about regionalization, I think.
Uh-huh.
I'll see if I can... If I scanned it in somewhere, if I have it. Otherwise, it's dead. Sorry.
No, sure. Good. John?
And just want to add to what Lyle was saying and something that we're doing now. In Massachusetts, the Department of Revenue, and I think it's the Division of Local Services, sort of their version of OPM, but they have a set group of staff that works on local issues. We're using some research they did for three communities in Western Mass on a shared town administrator to do a similar program in my region. So what they actually do is the towns will go to them and say, this is what we'd like to do. They do a little research for them, and then they have a grant program to provide, like the RPIP, to provide seed money so they can actually try it. And it appears that, you know, it's very similar to what is in the RPIP 2.0, but that kind of backup at the state level, coupled with funding and the desire of towns to do something, whatever it may be, seems to work quite well there.
Yeah. All right, good. Well, we've got some marching orders as far as an agenda item for our next meeting. So thank you all for that. Your contribution to that, and John for raising it. I think it's a useful and important thing to be looking at as we go forward. So with that, is there any other comments or that anyone else would like to offer? If not, I'll yeah, Bob.
I just got myself unmuted. I would just add to John's comment. There was handbook for selectmen that was done by the Institute for Public Service as well, and that is frankly not been updated a lot longer than the one for the boards of finance. But that type of a document for a small town, and particularly for a first selectman and board of selectmen, is a good document to understand the process and what is necessary in order to fulfill those responsibilities. So just add that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as we've been saying, there's a new world coming post-COVID. Maybe it is time to dust off some of these concepts, controversial or not, but be able to provide, if we're talking about best practices going forward, then, you know, maybe this is the moment to actually start reinvigorating and reviving some of these past practices, which I frankly didn't even know about. So thank you all for that. Any other thoughts before we adjourn? Okay, if not, we don't need to make a motion, but so we'll just consider ourselves adjourned for the subcommittee purposes.
All right.
Yeah, Lyle?
I'll just stop recording then. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sure. So we'll see you all. We'll be sending out some other information between now and then, but we'll see you all on April 9th. So thanks and have a great day. Appreciate it.
Thank you.